Good morning.
Morning.
It's good to see all of you on this after Easter Sunday. You never know what you're going to get on Easter Sunday or the Sunday after Easter, but it's good to see all of you here. It's good to see some visitors. We're welcome. We're glad you're here with us. During this time between the 50 or so days between the resurrection and the ascension, 40 days, 50 to Pentecost, what I want to do with these sermons is to try to pay very close attention to how we see Jesus. And if you're coming to the classes in the morning before our worship, which I hope you do, we're doing the opposite. We're trying to see how Jesus looks at us. And I think if we can put those two things together, we can kind of meet somewhere in the middle and kind of understand one another a little bit better. One of those moments where I think we have an opportunity to see things more clearly is those times when the world stops feeling stable, not necessarily because everything has fallen apart, but because something changes just enough that you no longer feel certain about what comes next, or moments when the future feels unclear, or the ground beneath you feels less solid, and you find yourself paying closer attention to what could go wrong rather than what's going right. It doesn't take much for that to happen. A conversation, a diagnosis, conflict, a loss, a change you didn't expect, and then suddenly the world feels less predictable than it did before. Those moments we find unsettling. And when that happens, most of us respond in very similar ways. We look for things that are predictable. We look for ways that we can regain control. So we start to manage what we can. We have idioms and cliches that highlight this logic, this philosophy well. We talk about making sure that we exert control over the things we have control over and letting go of the things that we don't. We start tightening things up. We start creating boundaries. We limit exposure. And sometimes it looks practical and wise, and sometimes it looks like distance. We pull back. We keep a conversation on a surface level, or we avoid a situation, or we hold back from something that feels risky. We learn how to protect ourselves, how to reduce risk, how to keep the world from getting too close. And that makes sense. And it's not weakness. It's just the human thing to do. We're trying to live wisely in a world that doesn't always feel safe. So we begin to believe, often without saying it out loud, that if we could just control our environment, then maybe we can control what happens to us next. If we can manage the room, then maybe we can manage the outcome. In that kind of world, fear dominates. It's logical. Fear makes sense. Closing the door makes sense. Trying to manage what we can, to hold things together, to keep ourselves from being overwhelmed, that all makes sense. It's how we learn to live when the world feels uncertain and we just don't know what's going to come next. And that's exactly the kind of space that this next story takes place in. Not out in the open, not in a moment of clarity or confidence, in a room shaped by fear, filled with people who are doing the best they can to hold things together. So listen for that. Listen for the fear, and listen for what happens when Jesus meets them right there in the middle of their fear. The word of the Lord from John chapter 20, verses 19 through 31. When it was evening on that day, the first day of the week, and the doors were locked where the disciples were, for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After he said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Then the disciples rejoiced when they saw the Lord, and Jesus said to them again, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, so I send you." When he said this, he breathed on them and said to them, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive the sins of any, they are forgiven them. If you retain the sins of any, they are retained." But Thomas, who is called the twin, one of the 12, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We've seen the Lord." But he said to them, unless I can see the mark of the nails in his hands and put my finger in the mark of the nails in my hand in his side, I just will not believe it. A week later, his disciples were again in the house, and Thomas was with them. And although the doors were still shut, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." And then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here, see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Do not doubt, but believe." Thomas answered him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus said to him, "Have you believed because you've seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have come to believe." Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples that are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may continue to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that through believing, you may have life in his name. The disciples gathered together behind closed doors, but not just closed doors, locked doors. They are afraid. And we need to get our timeline straight, okay? They've already heard news that something has happened. Some of them have seen the empty tomb. Some of them have talked to Mary, and they've heard that Jesus has been seen. And yet here they are, inside, locked in. They're still trying to manage what they can control. Resurrection has been announced. It has not yet changed anything about their lives. They are still very much afraid. And that's the tension. The world has shifted around them, but their experience of the world hasn't moved an inch. Fear is still shaping that room. The doors are still locked, and I assume double locked, and though John doesn't say it, I would be shocked if there wasn't a chair propped underneath the handle. The risk is still real. At any moment, the same people who arrested and killed Jesus could knock on that door and arrest them. Nothing on the outside of that room has changed enough to make them feel safe. Nothing. Not even Mary's testimony. We tend to assume that if something as powerful as resurrection were true, that if we experienced that, then it would immediately resolve everything. There'd be no doubt left in the room. That fear would disappear, that clarity would arrive, that people would step forward with confidence and boldness. And that is just not what happens. Not here. Even after Easter, the room is still filled with uncertainty. Even after the news of new life, they are still holding on to the patterns that help them feel secure. Nothing's changed for these young men. And then, without warning, Jesus appears. He comes and he stands among them. It's the most understated sentence in this chapter. Behind the locked door that's been barricaded and the dressers shoved in front of it, behind all of that, when the windows are barred, Jesus just pops up in the room and says, "Hello there. Peace be with you." I don't know if you've ever tried that before. If you ever tried to sneak up on somebody and said, "Peace be with you," the one thing that's not going to be in the room is what? Peace. They're not going to have it. They're terrified. They're screaming. I imagine they're trying to unbarricade the door and get out. There is no peace in the room. You only say "peace be with you" whenever everybody else is losing their minds in fear. They are overcome with fear. He comes and stands among them. He does not wait for the doors to be open. There's no "knock and ye shall find." There's none of that. He doesn't wait for them to find courage. He doesn't text first and says, "I'm here," so he doesn't raise their anxieties. There's no preemptive warning. He doesn't stand outside until they're ready for it. He just pops up right there in the middle of the room, in the room that they have closed off, in the middle of the fear that is ruling over their lives, in the world that they are experiencing, pops up. And the first thing he does is to speak peace. Not after everything is resolved, not once they've calmed down, not because the danger has passed, not when they've proven their faith. He pops up, speaks peace into the room that's full of fear, a room that is still shaped by uncertainty, that's full of people that are still holding all the tension that they're trying to manage. And then he shows them his wounds. That's not what you want to see in this moment. You want to see no wounds. I mean, theoretically, right, you want to see that everything's been undone, that if he's really back, that he's at full 100%. And he's not. Not really. He still bears the marks of the power that they are afraid of. He bears the scars of the things that have caused them fear. It's not a denial of what has happened. It's not a moment that erases the suffering they had. It doesn't pretend that everything is fine. The wounds are still there. The story of pain has not been removed. But now, all of that is held within something bigger. Peace does not come to them by removing what has been broken. It comes through the presence of the one who has already passed through it and come out the other side. Even Thomas, who's not there the first time, who gets left out of this for a week, when he struggles to believe, Jesus does not dismiss him or push him aside. He meets him in that same place the same way. He does not demand certainty before offering himself. He gives himself so that trust can begin. The risen Christ is not found in protecting ourselves from what we fear. The risen Christ is found in a presence that meets us in the middle of fear. He does not demand a different room. He doesn't say, come out and see. Lazarus got called out of the tomb. Jesus pops into the locked room, meets him right there in the middle of it. That's the irony here. It's you've got to see it. They should have gone to the tomb to see that it was empty, and they were too afraid to do that. Only one of them managed to go inside. And so now he pops into the room where they're hiding for fear of death. And he becomes a different presence within that room. What changes for the disciples is not the outside world around them. Pilate still has power. Rome is still a threat. The centurions are still after them. They're still most undesirable numbers 1 through 12. The doors do not suddenly become unnecessary, but something in the room is different now because someone is present who is not there before. And that matters, because each and every one of us has a room just like this one. Places in our lives where fear quietly shapes how we move, how we respond, how we cut ourselves off from the rest of the world. Conversations that we keep avoiding because we're just not sure how they're going to go. Situations that we try to control because we don't trust what might happen if we let go. I know for this particular room and this particular place in the country, the most terrifying thing I can say is this. The world will keep spinning if you don't keep making it. It will go on without you. The job will continue. The things will happen. The world will keep moving if you stop trying to force it to all hold together. We try to control things because we just don't trust what's going to happen if we let go. Or worse, we might not be needed anymore. Patterns of distance, silence, withdrawal can all feel safer than stepping forward into something uncertain. We learn how to keep those things contained, and over time it starts to feel like that's the only way to live in a room like that. So we lock the doors, we barricade ourselves in, we cut ourselves off because it's just too risky out there. But this story suggests something different. The invitation is not to unbarricade your life. The invitation is not to pretend that places are safe. There's no point in this story where Jesus denies what they're afraid of. He never tells them not to be afraid. He just says, peace be with you. He's told them not to be afraid before. He knows those words. He's used them. This is not that moment. He doesn't deny their fear. He just says, let's find some peace in the middle of it. That's not to force ourselves to feel brave or to fake certainty. The invitation is to allow the presence of Christ to meet us in the middle of our fear before anything else changes, before we get new results, before the world shifts. And that begins to change us. Not the world around us, but us, how we live. Not all at once, not dramatically, but in small, real ways. When we choose to stay in a conversation instead of closing it down, when we take a step instead of withdrawing, when we allow trust to grow where control has been holding everything in place, when you realize that you don't have to have complete control over all the things anymore, not because the situation is resolved, but because you're no longer alone in the situation itself. Which means the question is not whether you can eliminate fear from your life. The question has always been what it would look like to take even one step forward in a place that is shaped by fear, trusting that Christ meets you there, that his presence can change how you approach fear. Not because everything is clear, not because the outcome is guaranteed, not because the risk is gone, but because his presence changes what is possible within the space of our fear. Peace does not come from controlling the room. They had no peace when they locked the door. It didn't make them feel better. Peace comes from the one who stands in the middle of the fear with you. And we are living in a moment where fear is not hard to find. Pick a direction and point. There is fear to be mongered. It shows up in the constant stream of news that makes the world feel unstable, unpredictable. It shows up in financial pressure, in questions about the future, in the outwardly quiet anxiety that screams inside about whether things will hold together or if they're all coming undone. Fear shows up in relationships that feel strained or uncertain. Fear is there when we are worried about saying the wrong thing or losing connections altogether. Fear shows up in our bodies and our health concerns. Fear shows up in everything we just cannot control enough for our own satisfaction. And even the things that you do feel like you got a handle on, you're afraid of losing that control. Even the places where you have defeated fear, the one thing you actually still have is the fear of losing that victory. It's everywhere. It's in the weight of carrying more than we know how to manage. Fear has this way of shaping the room long before we realize it. When was the last time you made a choice not out of fear? Or a choice that fear didn't have a say in? Or a choice that fear didn't try to pipe up and add its 2 cents? When was the last time you did something truly without any fear? One of the most powerful lines in Scripture is not in the Gospels, it's in the book of Hebrews, where it says that he came to remove the fear of death. Not just death. Removing death was easy with Lazarus. Removing death was easy with Jairus' daughter. Elijah and Elisha can remove death, but Jesus, he removed the very fear of death. What the presence of Christ does in a room like this one with locked doors is not remove all of that fear at once. The doors are still closed, the world outside is still complicated, the questions do not disappear, but something else enters the room. His presence interrupts the assumption that fear gets the final word. His peace does not come from resolving all the uncertainties, but from being with us in the middle of our uncertainties. When he can look at you and say, I get it. I was afraid the whole time they marched me to Golgotha. I didn't want to get arrested. I was afraid the whole time. It steadies us in what feels unstable. It loosens what fear has tightened. His presence creates space where everything has begun to close in. And over time, his presence begins to reshape that room, not by forcing fear out, but by no longer allowing fear to define what is possible. The disciples did not manufacture peace for themselves. They did not work their way into it or earn it through courage. They were met within their fear, and they received what they could not create on their own, the peace of his company in the worst of moments. That's how we come to this table. Not because everything in our lives is settled, not because we've resolved our fears or answered every question. You're going to leave this place and find something else to be afraid of. Guarantee it. I don't make many guarantees, but I can guarantee you that. You're going to leave from here today and you're going to find something else to be afraid of. But when we come to this table, our fears, not resolved, not answered, but our fears are met with the company of his presence, of the one who says, I get it, I was afraid of death too, but I came out the other side, and I'll stand here with you no matter what the fear is. And so he says, peace be with you. Not outside the door, not as he knocks, but he comes and he stands with them in their fear and says, let me bring some peace to this room. Let him bring some peace to this table. Let him bring some peace to those parts of your lives that are just so overwhelmingly afraid. Not because it's resolved, not because every question's been answered, but because he's there. He meets us in the rooms that we carry with us. He meets us in the uncertainty we have not been able to control. He meets us in the places where we are still learning to trust and says, it's scary out there. Let me bring some peace. And here at this table, we do not prove that we are ready. We receive what is given. Here at this table, he stands among us. He pops up and he says, peace. And you look around at the world and you see nothing but fear. But here in this table, see peace. Not resolutions, not problems solved, but a peace that you didn't have before. That's where the resurrected Christ meets us, in a world full of fear. In the middle of it all, with a word of peace. Let's stand and sing.